Well, a few weeks ago, I had the joy of preaching chapter 5, which was the other massive genealogy section in the first part of Genesis. And so Sean said he's going to start calling me Reverend Genealogy. but we'll have some fun with this morning. It'll help you if you're open to page 9 and 10 there in your Bible. Now, if you think back past couple weeks, so far in Genesis, we've seen that from the beginning, God the Creator has this passion for life. He has a passion for the thriving of creation. And yet all along there's been this kind of interaction with people. And God's image bearers, unfortunately, have a very different vision. We found out through Genesis that humans actually have a penchant for autonomy. Again and again, we grab the reins from God and we choose to try to run things ourselves, which always ends up in this spiral of violence and death. And we saw that especially in the flood story, which we just finished. And you'll remember God is grieved as he looks at the earth and he sees this rampant violence. And what he actually does is act to sustain life. And so he does that in a couple ways. First of all, he ends this particularly violent humanity that has sprung up. That's one thing he does, judgment. The other thing he does is preserve Noah and the family and the floating zoo, right? And he keeps them as this remnant. And that's God acting for life, right? And God promises, I'm not going to destroy the earth by flood again. And he blesses Noah's family. And things are looking really good for, like, a couple verses. and then what happens, you remember this from last week, Noah, for all his faith and all his obedience, we find out, has not actually overcome this sin and brokenness that has been present all through the beginning of Genesis. And we see that he has some pretty messed up family relationships, actually. And God says to Noah and his sons in chapter 8, the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. So what we're doing this morning is we're continuing by asking the question that we've asked all along in Genesis, which is, will life thrive as God intends it to? Is life going to continue? Or is humanity, who's kind of constantly pursuing death, are they going to undo this plan of life that God has? And the other question is, what's God going to do about it? What's God going to do about a humanity that is essentially deconstructing the creation that he's made? So we'll look at that this morning. The text today has three pretty clear sections. There's two genealogies, and then in the middle, there's this one story about a tower. And there's an outline on the back of your bulletin that may help you keep track of where I'm going. So first of all, we're going to talk about the Table of Nations, which is this reading from Genesis 10. Now, this genealogy is a little bit different than the other ones. It actually has a huge scope to it. And so beyond a genealogy, this is actually like a world atlas. And it's tracing the repopulation of the entire earth from Noah's three sons. And so you'll see there that it starts with Japheth, it moves on to Ham, and then Shem. So there's three sections with the three sons. Now, back in chapter 9, right after the flood, we saw God reiterate his desire for humanity to thrive and grow after the flood. And so he echoes this kind of joyful proclamation from creation. He says in chapter 9, God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And then just in case they missed it, he said it again in verse 7, and you be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it. And what we see in chapter 10 is that God's intention to the people, go out and be fruitful and multiply, we see it being carried out in spades here. Because this isn't just individual descendants in this table. Here we have entire people groups and nations and kingdoms that are being described. And so you see that at the end of each of the sons' sections in verse 5 and 20 and 31, it talks about their clans and their languages and their lands and their nations. And what's going on here is this exponential growth of human life post-flood. Geographically, if you want to think about it visually, it's kind of like a bullseye. So the passage starts with the people groups that are furthest away, and it kind of narrows in and zooms in until it gets to the descendants of Shem. And so the first kind of outermost ring is Japheth, and those are the people that are the furthest away. And these are people that we don't actually hear that much about in the Bible in general. But it includes people like the Greeks and the Phoenicians and people groups up in Turkey and kind of Armenia and kind of pretty far away from Israel. So then we ratchet in one step and we get to Ham. Ham's a little bit closer in. These are Israel's neighbors. And so a lot of times Israel will be warring with these people or maybe allying with these people. And so if you look in verse 6 there, you see Cush and Egypt and Put and Canaan. Cush is northern Sudan. Put is Libya. Canaan is that area of Israel and Palestine, right? So we get the sense that we're getting a little bit closer into the Bible lands here. We also read about Nimrod, this mighty hunter, founder of a number of cities, a lot of them being in modern-day Iraq and Iran, including Babel. So that's getting in closer to the promised land, right? And then finally, we get to Shem. Now, there's this pattern in Genesis. You might have noticed it by now, that the chosen line, the line through which God is going to bless or carry forward his intentions, is always listed last, right? So later on, we'll see that it's Esau and then Jacob. Jacob is last, right? And it's kind of this this narrowing in effect. That's the pattern here. Shem is actually, we'll find out later, going to be at the center of the bullseye. It's what we're focusing on. If you look at verse 24 there, it talks about Shelah fathering Eber. Earlier, it talks about how Eber is the father of these descendants. Eber is where the word Hebrew comes from. So Eber here is actually the great-great-grandfather of all the Israelites. And it says, to him were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg. It sounds like maybe it should be in Moby Dick or something. Peleg, I don't know. For in his days, the earth was divided, it says. And his brother's name was Joktan. That's an interesting description. Peleg means itself, the word means division in Hebrew. And it says it's because the earth was divided. And it might be speaking about the Tower of Babel there. I'm not exactly sure. But there's another division that's in this passage, and there's a division in the line between two of Eber's sons here. So the rest of this chapter here in chapter 10 is going to follow Joktan's line. So you'll notice all of his sons show up there, and they occupy this area kind of around Saudi Arabia. But Peleg's line, we're actually going to pick it up in chapter 11 in the second genealogy, and you'll see that's going to be significant. So there's a division here between the kind of general descendants of Shem that spread around the area. And there's one particular line, though, of Shem's descendants, whom God is going to choose for a special purpose. Okay, so what in the world to make of all of this? Well, I think the first thing to notice that is pretty significant is that all people on earth share a common ancestry. And they all share this common inheritance, actually. So whether all the people groups on the earth know it or not, this command of God is upon them to be fruitful and multiply, that the image of God is upon them, that God is their creator. They share this same inheritance of sin from Adam as well. So this is a pretty interesting thing to say, especially maybe when this was written, that all the known peoples of the earth share the same family tree, Israel and also her most bitter enemies through the centuries. They're essentially related. I think what that means that is, as bad as things get with other people, they're still family in a sense. Maybe they're estranged, like the prodigal son, and yet there's this sense of the human family being brother and sister to each other. And I think that's just fantastically encouraging. Maybe a little bit shocking as well, especially in the last couple of weeks where I've felt more than ever that we live in a very fractured and fearful world. To remember that your enemy also bears God's image, that they're your relative in some sense under God, the creator of all people. Now, if you play that out a little bit, the logical outcome of that must be what Jesus taught. Love your enemy, pray for those who persecute you, feed and clothe and welcome the stranger, because in a sense, they're just a part of your family. The second thing that we should notice here is that the Hebrews don't have a super remarkable start. Eber kind of shows up there. It's not really, you would maybe expect in Israel's kind of origin story that Eber would be like a little bit more significant, or like that maybe he would be the mighty warrior or the mighty hunter. But he's just kind of a dude that shows up in the genealogy. Israel's not really that old of a culture. They're not very advanced technologically. They don't even have a land claim, actually, in this passage. Joktan has this all this territory that's claimed for him in Saudi Arabia. Eber doesn't have any territory that's assigned to him. And God reiterates this idea several times in Exodus. He says, basically, to Israel, you're not that special. By any exterior kind of measure, You're not that great. By your own merit, you're not that great. Really, I just chose you. I chose you, not because you're remarkable, but I chose you. And what we see here is out of all of this family, this family of God, God chooses Israel out of all of these different nations for a purpose. Not because they're really that special, but because he has a plan to bless the world through them. Okay, so that's the first genealogy. That was pretty good, right? You guys are tracking with me? Okay. Let's talk about Babel. This is pretty exciting here. We love this story, don't we? This is a really, I think most people, whether they're religious or not, would know this story. It's well loved. It's just like the flood story in that it's a chiasm, which Alan talked about a little bit last week. It means that the two halves of the passage are mirror images of each other. And so the first half of this passage talks all about the plans of the people and what they're doing. The middle talks about God coming down to see. And then the second half talks about God's plans. So people's plans and God's plans. It's like God responding to what they're doing. Let's look at the builders. They've got the material. They've got their bricks. Their building plan is epic. Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. It's like all the condos in Richmond, right? Actually, it's not, because archaeologically, this tower is what we would call a ziggurat. These were built all over ancient Mesopotamia, and they're kind of like pyramids, except that they have steps like this, like a wedding cake. Maybe you've seen this in history books before. Now, the word Babylon, which is where Babel is the word that's related to, in Akkadian, it means gate of God. And that's what a ziggurat was considered to be. It was a gate between heaven and earth. So at the very top of a ziggurat, this is really interesting, right? There's actually a living room at the top of this. There's like a table and a bed and just like a place for someone to live. And it was actually a place for God to live. And so the idea was you kind of build this thing up in the sky, and then the God's going to come down and kind of live in the top of your ziggurat. And you can go up to see the God up there. And maybe if you're lucky, you can maybe offer some sacrifices and entice that God to come down the ziggurat and to bring blessings down to your people, to your land. So actually, these towers were technology for controlling a God, for housing a God. They say, let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. The goal here is to consolidate power and control, right? This is nation building that we're talking about. This is strength in numbers. And the one thing that's really clear is that this is directly resisting God's command to Noah, right? And throughout Genesis, where he says, be fruitful and spread across the earth, multiply, go out. And indeed, this account is actually the exact opposite of what we just read about in Genesis 10, with all of these people groups scattered all over the earth. The people of Babel want to build an outpost of human autonomy, self-determination. We'll stay right here. We'll run things for ourselves. Thank you very much. We're going to build a tower, and we're going to put a God in it, and he's going to bless what we're doing. And then we come to the top of this chiasm, which is where God comes down to look at the tower. And this part is really funny, because in their minds, they're building this tower up to heaven. And yet God, in Hebrew, he has to bend over and come all the way down to see it, as if he's like got a magnifying glass and he's looking at an anthill. and what you see there is that their project in divine terms to the true God, the creator God, this is a laughable project, as if somebody could build a ziggurat up to God or entice him to live in this little room or control him by their tower. And while Babylon means gate of God in Akkadian, in Hebrew, the word Babel means to confuse. And it's this commentary that's being put on this that is saying theologically, the builders of this tower are confused. Let's see how God responds. Now, you may read this and wonder, is God's ego threatened here? Is he being a little bit defensive or maybe a little bit harsh in his response? And I would say that the sense here is that God is not at all threatened by the tower. But something is threatened, and that's this idea of human life and thriving that we see God has been working towards all through Genesis. God is working for life. And what God's response here is actually a judgment of mercy. So he is responding, in a sense, negatively to what they're doing, but it's also he's also doing it to help them. He's doing it to their own good. And so you remember back in the beginning of Genesis when God removes them from the garden so that they can't access the tree of life, lest they live forever. It's the same kind of thing. God confuses their language, and then he disperses them over the earth, lest their plans, which are not good plans, right? lest they come to fruition. Let's take it all back one step. Chronologically, this account, I think, happens actually before the Table of Nations, or perhaps during the Table of Nations that we talked about. And that's because it specifically states in this account that they all have the same words in the same language, whereas in the Table of Nations, it says repeatedly that all of those clans have their own language. And so I think what we get here is a snapshot of how humanity was resisting that mandate to be fruitful and spread. And instead of obeying God's command, they're bunkering down and they're building monuments to themselves. And so when you think about that, this kind of what we see in chapter 10 is really a triumph of the human family growing and spreading and subduing the earth and doing kind of just exactly what God intended from the beginning, working to implement God's image on the earth. But actually, that's all God's doing, it turns out. That's what Babel is telling us. It's telling us that God was behind all of that diversification across the face of the earth. He did it by confusing language and by dispersing people. And actually, what God does in Babel is act in such a way to help people obey his intention. It's very ironic, actually. And what we see is that the kind of mercy and purpose of God stands behind all of this multiplication of clans and languages and nations and peoples. That God kind of gives them this like divine inoculant against the homogeneity and the hubris that they're building in Babel. Now, I think for a lot of us, when we've read this text before, we assume that this confusion of language was a curse. It was this highly negative thing, and that us, like brave Prometheus, can overcome it with Google Translate. But I think actually this scattering is a mercy. It's an aid to obeying God's intent. There's this sense that it's going to put a damper on their wickedness, on this multiplication of sin. And not only that, but we find out that later in the Bible, this kind of multiplication of language and culture is something that's beautiful to God. In Revelation, we learn that every tongue and tribe and nation is proclaiming God's glory in a multitude from every nation on earth, making up redeemed humanity. And so, if you think about Pentecost, the day of Pentecost, and the gift of tongues, often people will say that that God is fixing what happened at Babel, meaning that he was kind of being a bit mean by changing people's language, and now on the day of Pentecost, he's kind of just letting us communicate again. But I don't really think that's what it's about. If you're perhaps part of another religion, it's very important that you actually pray in a specific language that is the language of God, right? But we're not praying in Hebrew or Greek here. What Pentecost is about is the fact that in Christ, all the peoples on the earth are being blessed. Every nation, every tongue and tribe is going to be offered the gift of the gospel. They're all going to hear it in their own language, and they're all going to glorify God in their own language, which is what happens on Pentecost. And the Spirit of God is going to enable the powerful gospel witness of the church to spread out to every nation. And so at Pentecost, we do have proof that that Babel is fixed, but what is actually fixed is the deep brokenness of sin by the gift of the gospel. It's not that our diverse languages need to be fixed. And I think actually at the root of the sin of Babel is our desire to make this creator God, this really, really big God, into a tribal God, to imagine that he's a small enough God that we can put him in our own national image, that we can make him serve our national interest, that we can put God in a ziggurat of our own making and control him, in a sense that we can reverse it and put God in our image instead of being in God's image. But what is so glorious about Genesis is that God is the God over the entire human family, over the entire world, over the universe. He's the God behind all life. He's the one driving life forward. The Creator is behind, actually, this beautiful diversity of language and geography and culture that is spread across the face of the earth. He's a creator that has made the world with a multiplicity of ways for humans to act in his image. We don't all have to look the same or act the same to be in God's image. He's given us thousands of ways to tend the earth. We can keep it in 1,000 different ways. We can be fruitful in 1,000 different ways. We can call God Father with 1,000 different words. But how do we get there from Babel? That's the question. And that's what the third genealogy is about. So this is the name that God builds in chapter 11. Our third genealogy sets us up for how God is going to do this, how he's going to fix this. It's a pretty long go, just to warn you. We're pretty early on in the Bible, and it takes a while to get there. And there's going to be a lot of promises and patriarchs and prophets. It's going to happen over generations and generations. God is going to choose a particular people, and through that particular people, he's going to bring blessing. This genealogy should remind you of chapter 5. It's the same format, except for one thing. It leaves out the refrain of death that's in chapter 5. It talks about, and he died, and he died, and he died. In this genealogy, that's left out, which is really interesting. If you look in verse 17, you'll see that Eber show up again there. He has Peleg. There's no mention of Jotham at all here, the brother. He's not even mentioned. And so while in our first genealogy, there's this widening of every nation, every clan, every language on earth being talked about, in this genealogy, there's a narrowing. There's a passing on of the inheritance to one descendant in each generation. And here again, we see this line of God's calling and choosing. It's all leading up to a particular person in a particular time and place. Now, I've withheld one thing from you that's actually fairly important, and that's that the name Shem means name in Hebrew. You see that the people of Babel wanted to make their name great. But when you get over to chapter 12, you see that God promises to make the name of Abram great. The great-great-grandson of Shem, name, will have his name made by God. This is talking about the line of promise here. So in chapter 5, you may remember there's 10 generations between Adam and Noah. And in this genealogy, there's 9 generations between Shem and Terah. Readers of Hebrew text would have noticed that. Who's the 10th person? That's the question, right? I'll spoil the surprise for you. It's chapter 12. The 10th generation is Abram. Abram is the one through whom God is going to save, right? And Sean is going to preach about this next week, but I just have to give you a little bit of a preview. This is Abram, the descendant of Shem. Chapter 12, verse 2, I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. Him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. All the families of the earth, all of the clans, all of the languages and tribes from chapter 10 will be blessed through this chosen line. But here's where we leave off for today. We leave off with the knowledge that despite our human quest for autonomy, despite the fact that we make decision after decision that leads the world into violence and death, despite the fact that we try to make God in our image and we resist his purposes, God is yet our creator. He still desires life for the world. He's the father of the human family. And he intervenes in Babel as a mercy in order to help us fulfill his image. God also has a plan. He has a plan to restore all of these families completely, and he's going to do it through one tiny tribe out of many. One tribe chosen to bless the world through their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson, Jesus. So the message here is that life will continue and sin will be vanquished through the true descendant of Abraham. Amen.